Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Chocolate on Trial, Slavery, Politics, and the Ethics of Business, presented by Lowell Satry. It's session number SAL 2006-03. Let's listen in.
Partway going into business, and you remarkably successful businessman.
Isn't that a parable to the Jews in a lot of places?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. There's a parallel to the Jews. This company was one of the most widely admired companies in all of Britain. They had in the 1880s, when they expanded, built a modern factory that was second to none in Britain and was probably equal to any chocolate manufacturing company in the world. In this company, they not only provided excellent manufacturing situations, but they provided a swimming pool. They had their huge cricket fields. I mean, they had everything you would want, even today. And in many ways, the jobs were sought after. They were decent pay. It was, in fact, a very good pay. They also, around 1900, late 90s, one of the members, particularly the wealthiest, the oldest, the matriarch of the family, George Cadbury, began the construction of a model village called Bourneville. And model villages were the thing in England from about 1890 and on. So it isn't that George Cadbury came up with this idea. Model villages were, well, I can't say common, but were built throughout much of...
A social utopia.
Yeah.
But realistic rather than the...
Oh, they're beautiful. They're beautiful.
I meant as opposed to the utopian thinking.
Yeah, no, this was practical houses to live in. I mean, they were... you had to pay for them. I mean, you couldn't be poor and live in there. You had to be gainfully employed, member of the working class. And you didn't have to be working at Cadbury. You could be any working class person in that area of Birmingham who could, you could afford the rent, and they had them available, you could live there. They built 100 houses early on, and they continued to expand. And they made sure that there was a good-sized plot of land so people could have their own fruit trees or gardens. We walked through the area today, and I mean, none of us would mind living in those houses. Even today. Mm-hmm. And it's just a beautiful area.
Brick houses.
Pardon?
The brick houses.
Yeah, they're brick. They're all brick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 1901, this company heard reports, a little bit more than rumors, heard reports, that the cocoa beans that they were purchasing from the tiny island of San Tome, a Portuguese-owned colony off the west coast of Africa, take a look at Africa, let me make sure this one is functioning here. Africa is relatively easy to draw, so it should be a little higher, but San Tome is right here. It's right in what is called the armpit of Africa. It's in the Gulf of Guinea. And it is, there are two tiny islands, San Tome and Principe, located on the equator. The equator runs right through it. They heard reports that indeed the cocoa beans that they were purchasing from that area was created by slave labor. Now, keep in mind, Quakers were the leaders of the abolition movement in the 19th century. And here you have a Quaker-owned company that was, they were afraid, purchasing cocoa beans that were created by slave labor. And these are devout Quakers. I mean, they are serious, all Quakers are serious, these are some of the most serious Quakers. And so what they did was to set out to verify this. And I think it's also fair to say that Quakers wouldn't simply accept this. You know, they heard a report, they wouldn't say, oh, that's it, we're getting out of there. I mean, they would make certain that indeed the reports were true. I mean, they did not want to do harm to somebody who, in fact, was not doing it. So what they did for the next, actually it amounted to several years, it started in 1901, for the next several years, they made attempts to verify that indeed slave labor was used on these Portuguese-owned plantations on São Tomé and Príncipe. And they did this by, they contacted humanitarian societies, anti-slavery societies, to get reports from them. Another thing they did was to hire an agent to go out and study. Now, in order to make this person effective, well, first of all, they hired a Quaker who was not connected with the company, but whom they could trust, and they sent him to Portugal for 6 months to learn Portuguese. They didn't want to have sent somebody who would be totally dependent on somebody, on an interpreter to deal with the planters. And they gathered information, they sent their agent out, their agent went not only to São Tomé, but it went also to Angola. Angola, another Portuguese colony located roughly down in this area here. Because what happened and what their agent, when he came back and reported in 1906, 1907, he said, yes, there are slaves. The slaves originate in Angola. They are imported by middlemen and everybody. They are eventually imported and taken to São Tomé at the rate of about 4,000 per year. Now, on the other hand, Portuguese early on were criticized for it. Portuguese said, no, we have no slaves. Slaves were abolished in the whole Portuguese Empire, all the colonies in the 1870s. So we can't deal in slaves because it is illegal. So we have no slaves. And in fact, they were technically contract laborers. They all signed, they all essentially signed a document agreeing to go 5 years to São Tomé, at which at the end of that time they would be given the option to renew or to return. Investigations by the 1890s and certainly into the 1900s said not one single person had ever returned from São Tomé to Angola. Zero. And in fact, they recognized very quickly, all the investigators said, it's slavery, it's just camouflage. I mean, in fact, there was an unbelievably healthy slave trade. Those of you who've studied the slave trade of the Europeans beginning in the 1500s, of the capturing in the interior, of the moving them through the trails that are littered by bones, I mean, on the way to the coast, it was the same thing. It was slavery, except it went under the cloak of a contract. And Cadbury's basically had to make a decision. What to do? They purchased probably roughly half of their cocoa beans from São Tomé. And they had a choice of two things. They could simply boycott. They could begin immediately saying, we're boycotting. They could announce to the world, we're boycotting. There's slavery in that area. We're not going to touch it anymore. Or they could continue to buy it. And they, yeah.
So who set up the this system? It sounds like Cadbury were just acting as brokers and acquiring.
Cadbury's had nothing to do with the slave themselves. Okay. They were simply purchasers of cocoa beans that were grown there. In fact, they didn't buy them in São Tomé. They bought them primarily in Lisbon. That's where the cocoa beans ended up. Right. They were for lunch. This had developed from the 1870s and on. When they lost their slave labor, they had to have labor. I mean the key in all of this, whether it's in the in ancient Rome, Portuguese colonies in the early 1900s, or the United States operating some place today, you have to have labor. You have to have it. And they needed labor, and they could certainly get nobody to volunteer to go to this island. It was a death trap. The mortality rate ran in many of the plantations ran 20% a year because of the labor and living conditions. So that's why you needed 4,000 a year. To keep up a relatively small labor force of 25 to 30,000.
In Lisbon, were they getting all their cocoa beans basically from these two sources?
Much of it came from Greek, yes. I'm not sure that they probably gained some from elsewhere, but a lot of it came. Santome and Principe were the only profitable colonies the Portuguese government had. They made money.
Okay.
The only one. Okay. And of course it was in the very best interest of the Portuguese government to make certain that they facilitate labor for São Tomé in turning, including those who might not like it, turning a blind eye to what was going on.
And turn around and make the sale of cocoa beans a profit.
Yeah.
And so if Lisbon was mostly getting their stuff from here, what other major choices did Canterbury in England have
Cocoa? They could buy it from Central America and increasingly from Bahia region of Brazil. Brazil came to be ultimately a big producer.
Was that more expensive to buy?
No, not really. Expense isn't the important thing here.
Okay.
Part of it had to do with taste, because cocoa beans differ from one area to another. But no, the price is it's like oil today. I mean, there's a little difference in whether you get it from North Sea crude in the North Sea or you get it from the Middle East. There's a little difference, some a little sweeter, and some has more sulfur and everything. But it's essentially an international commodity that differs relatively little per gallon and per bag. Mm-hmm. That's the same with cocoa bean.
Yeah, and coffee.
It's not the cocoa. Right, all right, yeah. It's the same.
So they had two choices. That's where you are.
Yeah, what now?
They had two choices.
Oh, yeah, okay. They had two choices. Thank you. I need you.
It was here in my notes.
Oh, okay. Well, they had two choices. That is to boycott or to continue buying. And they made the decision to continue buying. The argument being that, look, if we simply stop purchasing, if we boycotted it, we lose any power. Mm-hmm. They said if we continue purchasing, we have the power of purchase. Mm-hmm. And we can tell, and they did this, they essentially went to the Portuguese government and to the Portuguese planter saying, unless you mend your way, unless you move to free labor, moving away from slave labor, we're going to stop buying. They said if we simply boycotted it, what would happen? Other companies, far less scrupulous than us, will step in.
So they basically took it on as a cause.
Well, they did. They did.
They still made money.
Now we're getting into the...
Yeah.
that's another part of it.
Yeah.
This evolved from about 1905 to 1909, this decision they had to make and to continue to use it or to boycott it. And early on, there were people in England who basically said, you're not doing the right thing, Cadbury's. Because first of all, they said, you're dealing with the Portuguese, and what you're confronting now in 1904, 1905, no different than what was going on 20 or 30 years ago. These are greedy bums. I mean, they've been at it, they're used to it. They're not, you can do all the pleading and pushing and everything you want with them, they're not going to mend their way. And the one that particularly put pressure on Cadbury's included journalists. And the greatest of these journalists was a man who was one of the main characters in this book, a man by the name of Henry Nevinson. Henry Nevinson, in fact, had gone out to São Tomé in Angola at virtually the same time as Cadbury's agent had gone out in 1904-1905. He met them. They talked to each other. They met on the island of São Tomé. So they knew each other. Nevinson came back. He'd actually been hired by Harper's Magazine, an American magazine. He'd been given £1,000 plus expenses to go and write something exciting. And he'd run around London for a few weeks saying, what's exciting in the world? And he knew a number of humanitarians, and they said, there's something in Portugal you ought to take a look at. And that's how he ended up with it. He wasn't assigned. He chose it. And he ended up going there. He never learned the language, but he was a remarkable linguist outside of he didn't speak Portuguese, and most people didn't. And he went there, and in 6 months, he went through São Tomé and Angola. He almost died in Angola. He came back and he wrote, there was 8 articles he published beginning in August of 1905 into early 1906, published in Harper's, but having a wide distribution in England. And then it was published, the articles were published as a book in early 1906 called The Modern Slavery. And he was the one who actually kept it on the front burner for several years, not only with his articles, his books. He gave speeches, he gave talks, he appeared before humanitarian societies. He was kind of the conscience of people at that time. But there were others also, that humanitarian societies became involved, anti-slavery societies, 2 of them functioned in England. And one of them was headed by a neat man by the name of Henry Fox Bourne. He was an old curmudgeon. He'd been around a long time. He'd been a writer through much of his early life. He served in the government, in the war office. He knew people in the foreign office. He was one of the people that knew everything. He knew how it operated. He brooked no opposition, and people in the foreign office, you know, they'd get a missive from him, a long 5-10 pages spelling it out. You know, they cringed when they got it, but they knew he was right. I mean, he's the kind of person who was always right, but you could never admit it publicly, somebody like that. He was a muckraker par excellence. I mean, he was absolutely outstanding. The leader of the anti-slavery society was Buxton, and if any of you ever studied any of the anti-slavery movement in England in the 19th century, Buxtons were leaders of the anti-slavery movement in England from the 1820s and on, and here was the great grandson or something from the original president, who was now the executive secretary. He was not nearly as strong as this Henry Fox Bourne, because partly, I think, because there were Cadburys who contributed especially to the anti-slavery society. Cadburys were a powerful family. They had friends all over England, and particularly the humanitarian society, so they didn't put a lot of pressure on Cadbury. But so this is what was going on, and you know, the criticism of Cadbury's began early on. Now the company persisted in its plan of continuing to purchase the cocoa beans. They put pressure on the Portuguese owners, politicians. They regularly visited Lisbon, the capital, and talked to politicians there. And they also contacted the British Foreign Office to explain what was happening, what they had determined about the production of cocoa beans. They also indicated when they met with the Foreign Secretary, Edward Grey, that they had an agent who was there. He was going to be back by about 1906. This is what we're doing. Do you have any recommendation on what we should do? Now, Edward Grey was a member of the Liberal government. It was the most progressive, liberal, forward-looking government England had ever had. It was the government that in 1908 introduced old-age pensions. It was the company, the one that introduced food for children in schools, the poor children, by 1906, 1907. They brought forth the birth of the National Health Service, the very beginnings of it, in 1911. I mean, it goes on and on and on. There's a long list of admirable things that happened. And Edward Grey was a part of it. He gained far more notoriety later on because he was the Foreign Minister of England when England entered World War I in 1914. But Grey and the other functionaries of the office essentially said, we are well aware, and they were well aware. They've known this for 2-3 decades. Nothing. And they said, certainly when he comes back, let us see the report. But let us ultimately handle this by diplomatic means. So don't go broadcasting it too much, just kind of like that. In time, they'll be quiet about it, but let us handle it. Well, Cadbury never knew at that time, and I don't know that they ever knew. And in fact, there was no way that the British government was going to put pressure on Portugal for 2 reasons. Portugal was held important colonial property in Africa, and England was already wary of the power of Germany. So they weren't going to alienate their oldest ally. Portugal had been an ally from the 14th century. The oldest ally was almost a 600-year ally. A weak ally, but a neat ally because you're pushing around. But it was still happening. So, the second thing is that the South African War, the Boer War, had been waged from 1899 to 1902. That war had led to a great sense of the destruction, or at least the closing down of the mines in South Africa, especially the gold mines, which was the great economic center of South Africa. And they absolutely needed labor. They did a stupid thing. Only greedy capitalists could do it. They decided, well, we need more labor. Now, how are we going to get it? We're going to cut their going wages in half from what they'd been paying them before the war started. What a stupid way to gain labor. Well, they were saving money. But they went to China and got a number of Chinese cruelty labor, which was common throughout the world at this time, including, of course, the western part of the United States. That didn't work real well. What they really focused on was getting Portuguese colonial labor from the colony of Mozambique over here. They contracted them by the thousands to work in the Johannesburg area of South Africa. And there was no way the British government was going to put very much pressure on Portugal to mend their ways in São Tomé for fear that they would alienate their labor source from Mozambique. The British would alienate their labor source from Mozambique.
And Mozambique was Portuguese.
Yeah, the Portuguese labor from Mozambique. Oh. The native, the aboriginal.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Mozambique was Portuguese.
Yeah.
The British were getting labor.
Yes.
For
South Africa.
Gold
mines.
Yeah. From Portugal.
Yes.
Isn't it ironic that
labor, right?
Oh, really? What's that?
Isn't it ironic that we don't want cheap labor from Mexico?
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was also contract labor because it couldn't be. Sold.
Yeah, that was contract. That was pretty controversial too. But not.
But I'm saying legally.
But it was more legal.
It was contract. Yeah. But I mean, that was contract labor. So.
But it wasn't slavery. Because they indeed were contracted for a year, and almost all of them returned to Mozambique. So it wasn't slavery.
Okay.
That was just contract slavery,
okay.
Not slavery. Now that's the diplomatic part. I just wanted to emphasize a little bit. Let me go on to the company's response and all of this. There are some admirable things about Cadbury's in this. It is one of the first, if not the first, major company to actually be concerned about the labor used to produce its basic commodities.
It
is one of the first.
It is.
It may be indeed the first to actually be concerned. It may have not taken the right steps right away, but they were concerned. And it was very admirable. But the company also had to be concerned with its profits. It had to be concerned with its own employees. And early on, they said, well, what's going to happen if these carry on a boycott? And one of the directors, one of the Cadbury, said, well, if we'll be, we'll have to go on short time, and we'll probably cost at least 500 employees their jobs for a while. Perhaps up to a half a year. And they had about 3,500 employees. So it would be laying off 5,500. They were concerned. This was something that entered in. They also fairly early had begun working for an alternative source for cocoa beans. And it's controversial, and it's scholars are still arguing about it today, and that is when Cadbury's finally began boycotting it in 1909, they had to a certain extent had begun developing another source of cocoa beans in what was called the Gold Coast then, it's the Ghana today. And scholars say in their articles about it, you know, they weren't going to boycott it until they got another source. And the whole question in all of this was that did Cadbury put company business ahead of humanitarianism? And there's nothing easy. It's not a clear cut. You know, if this whole thing were clear cut, it would be a short story. Right? But it's not. It's gray. There's gray. Almost everything we do in life has a lot of gray.
And it's fortunate for you, because then...
Yeah, otherwise I couldn't read a book.
That's exactly it. You could make money on this.
Well, no. I will buy it. I mean, I really make money.
I'm trying to, but still.
And in fact, all of the people, if you ever read the book, one thing you'll notice is that all these people are real human beings. I mean, they all have their strengths, they have their weaknesses. I mean, they argue with each other. The humanitarians, especially, couldn't get along with each other. There were major differences among the Quakers over, and in fact, some of the real pressure against Cadbury came from their fellow Quakers, because they wanted them to begin the boycott. Reporters, especially Henry Evanson, had a very thin skin. He was a brilliant journalist. And he was until the 1940s, but he had a thin skin. He'd be criticized. Go ahead.
I just want to add, I read the book, and what he's saying is so fun, because it's like reading archives about missionaries. Oh. Where we want to think, they're all in agreement over there in Madagascar or in the mission fields or whatever. They had their own, like you say, humanitarian struggles, deeply challenged each other, even though they were in the same cause.
It's a real interesting human story involved in all.
And you put a lot of it into the book.
Yeah.
Just plug it.
You get 10%.
There, obviously, Cadbury's was protecting its company's reputation. It had one of the best reputations in England. Aside to all of this, but an important part of it, and those of you who have read it will recognize it, one of the directors of the company, George Cadbury, was also a major newspaper owner. He owned the Daily News. It was the most important liberal party newspaper in England. He was so devoted, he was so angry at the Conservatives for the Boer War. I mean, he just didn't buy it, period. And the Liberal Party lacked a voice in the huge London newspaper market that he bought it and turned it over to the Liberal Party or a Liberal editor to take care of it. And he bankrolled the rest of his life. He died in 1920. And he bankrolled it to the tune of several £20,000-£30,000 a year. And they went after the Conservative government during the Boer War and the post-Boer War. They were critical of the Conservative government every way possible. Except in all of this, George Cadbury and others, they basically told the newspaper, we don't want you reporting about what's going on in São Tomé. I mean, it's ironic that here those who espouse freedom of the press and digging up all the information possible, when it came to their own self-interest, they pulled back. And one of the biggest criticisms you will find, I think, in the book, I mean, it's implied criticism of Cadbury for that reason. Cadbury's was so careful at protecting its image that when articles appeared in newspapers calling into question what Cadbury was doing, they contacted the newspaper and say, we're doing things, we're serious. Unless you retract it, we're going to sue you for libel. So there were two major British newspapers in 1906 and 1907 who did retract it. I mean, they basically said, they have been doing things, and they would run an article in their paper saying, and this would have come directly from Cadbury's, and what they were doing, including sending out the agents, the pressure they were putting on the government and putting on the Portuguese landowners and government and all that. They spell it out. And that's the power of a big corporation. It's a form, we talked yesterday when we talked about freedom of the press, it's a form of self-censorship that comes through. But finally, in 1908, there was a newspaper, The Standard, in London, which was a conservative newspaper, and all this is all, I've gone into the politics, but the politics of conservatism and liberalism is all played out in this book, too. The Standard essentially said in an editorial, Cadbury, all this stuff you've done, all this pressure you say you put on is just a sham. You're concerned about one thing. You want to, first of all, you want to maintain your good reputation. But in fact, behind all of this, you're concerned about the bottom line. And you use the term, you're hypocrites. And Cadbury sued them for libel. And the center or the core of this book deals with a libel trial in December of 1909, involving Cadbury's and The Standard. And it is, I won't tell you the outcome of it, because you have to read the book to do that, but it is the two sides hired by far the most expensive and ablest attorneys in Great Britain. Without a doubt, they were the best. And one of the neat things about us, it turns out, is their personalities are so different. The one person focused on identifying, making certain that the jury identified with his story, and he played on their emotions, and he didn't worry about facts. And the other one defending Cadbury's, Cadbury's, was meticulous in detail. I mean, he was just the opposite of how, and they were both wonderfully successful, and this is the fourth or fifth libel trial they had been on opposite sides. So it was almost like they were on a circuit. From 1904 to 1909, you had these two politicians, barristers, arguing the various cases, and they about split the decisions. They about split them. And they were very good friends. There's a good chance that when they rode, the trial occurred was in Birmingham, England. And of course, they were living in London. Chances are pretty good that when they went back on the train, they probably sat with each other
and laughed
all the way back. Because certainly they got paid handsome for quite a bit. But I won't go into that.
But they weren't in partnership.
Oh, no, 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 not at all. No, they were not in partnership. Oh, no, no. Politically, they were worlds apart. It's very similar to the Senate today or the House of Representatives. The U.S. Senate today is a big club.
Sure.
You know, they may shout at each other and call each other names on the floor, but, you know, once they go back into those committee rooms, they're buddies. I mean, it's...
And yet, right now, the critique is that that's not going on enough.
I know. And that's right. Yeah. That's right. Forced labor continued, actually, for quite some time in Portugal. Technically, it continued until the 1950s. It continued until the 1950s. It was an age-old thing.
Until independence, then.
Okay. Yeah, well, independence occurred in the 1970s. Forced labor, one way or another, continued until independence in the 1970s. Yeah, in Angola, Mozambique, and in São Tomé. The story continues up to the present day. In 2001, there was a ship off the west coast of Africa that became disabled. And rumors quickly spread and were confirmed that indeed there were children who had been essentially sold into slavery or kidnapped on board the ship. It made international news because it was disabled, and it went into one port and they wouldn't permit them to stop, and they went to another port, and when it was all, you know, when they were released and everything, there were about 25 children under the age of 10 that were in fact going to be served either as domestic servants or were going to end up as being slaves in some of the plantations, including the cocoa plantations in that area. And I remember when it happened, it was big international news, and you could follow the newspapers, I think it was in the U.S. media and everything. And that brought out a spate of information including in the United States, an attempt on the part of the U.S. government to make certain the U.S. chocolate company did not buy commodities that had any possible taint of slavery. And Elliot Engel from New York, a New York representative, House of Representatives from New York, Elliot Engel, and Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, came up with what is referred to as the Harkin-Engel, or the Engel-Harkin, number which it is, protocol. And this and it's a protocol. It is not a law, it is a protocol, in which companies were to make certain within a five-year period that they purchased no cocoa beans that were produced by slave labor, and that they set up a monitoring system to certify that no slavery was used. Now, U.S. companies agreed to it. In some ways, they're not to. They agreed to it. They're not to, you know. Why aren't you going to do it? So they agreed to it. And July 1st of 2005, a year ago, the International Labor Defense Fund, it's a civil rights, human rights organization out of Washington, D.C., filed suit against Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, and those two were probably the biggest dealers of commodities in the United States and probably the world, filed suit against Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, and Nestle's for aiding and abetting the enslavement of children from Mali, a West African country, to work in the cocoa fields of the Ivory Coast. There are now estimates of at least 2,500 children who are slaves in the cocoa fields, primarily of the Ivory Coast. If anything, that's increased over the last few years because the price of commodities has tended to dip. They've come up a little bit in the last couple of years, but the price the big companies pay for commodities has decreased. And an argument can be made is that these commodity dealers, like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill, are so huge, they can force the price down, simply by indicating that instead of paying a dollar a pound, they're going to pay 75 cents a pound. And they're so big, they're so powerful, farmers frequently have no choice but to say, well, okay, because they don't have an alternative to sell to, because they have that much purchasing power. We have about 5 or 6 minutes to go here.
So, you said they brought suit against them. Were they able to...
Oh, it's still in court. And I have no doubt it'll go on for years.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that is simply the power of any corporation nowadays, especially a corporation this size. That can be in the courts for years and years. It can be in 5 or 10 years. That's just a guess. Mm-hmm. We all know how long it takes.
Few people like you follow
those... Well, like the international, International Labor Defense Fund.
Okay.
I think it's in, I don't know if it's in the book or not. I don't remember. I think it is.
There's a lot in the book.
I think it is. Right at the end. The last two, three pages brings it up essentially to the present day. Now, this problem in the cocoa industry in many ways is no different than so many other commodities today. I mean, certainly one of the biggest problems the last few years has been in the diamond industry. If you follow that at all, I mean, the civil wars in Liberia, for instance, in the neighboring countries, a lot of that is fueled essentially by the diamonds that are dug in that area. And certainly some of that is forced labor, one way or another, it is. And now, of course, they're trying to what do you call it? You can technically identify every single diamond.
Yes.
Can be identified.
Yes, there's advertising.
So that indeed, if it's coming out of
wasn't produced by
I don't know how you do it, but you essentially You know, essentially put a mark in it.
Yeah.
That can be identified anywhere.
I've seen it.
And doesn't the carrot come from a carob, which is how they were weighed? So
what's that now?
The carob and cocoa, how are they similar? Carob beans? I think that's where the word carrot comes from. So
I know. Carob is kind of a what, chocolate substitute, we call it, or something like that.
And I think carrot comes from that. So
I don't.
I know there's a weight thing, but
you know,
there
are alternatives.
And then chocolate. You mentioned that the advertising for chocolate is very big these days. On you can afford to buy the best chocolate for yourself, and we can guarantee you our brand does not use slave labor. Does not use slave labor. I mean, I've seen.
That's not easy.
That's right.
That's right. Now, there are certain ways to overcome it, and I mean that is to buy fair trade.
But even there?
No, it's pretty good. I mean, from what I can tell,
how would I trust?
Well, because they have in place what you call certification. I mean, they will have people on the ground actually visiting those cocoa plantations. It's not easy. I mean, believe me, it is not easy to find that. I mean, just as Nevinson and Burt, the two investigators, had a hard time finding the places in Egypt, it's the same today. I mean, I'll tell you, there are places in the Ivory Coast that nobody's ever visited. Mm-hmm. Nobody. And it's not easy for an Archidiano of Midland who, well, in some ways it's easy because they have the resources. If they really wanted to put the resources in, they could identify. Mm-hmm. But that costs money.
I think Holden does buy fair trade, you know,
in
the gift store there.
Right. Like, but I mean, I'm enough of a cynic that
it's
trouble thinking, should I spend the extra money?
You know, another question that comes into it is, how much higher prices are you willing to pay?
That's just what I said.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Walmart's criticized, and rightly so, I mean, for how they buy and how they force it, but there are a lot of people in the United States who are economically so deprived that they have trouble not buying at a Walmart or similar thing. It's tough.
Well, it seems like Hallmark makes up these holidays so you can buy cars. So maybe Cadbury makes up other little things that you can give more chocolate, you know, like Easter seems to be really pushed a lot more chocolate in the last 50 years.
Thus far, Cadbury has avoided any lawsuits or any indication that they are buying from illegal or those sources, because they buy almost everything from Ghana.
So since this suit that you wrote about,
they've not been charged. No, they have not. No British manufacturers have been charged.
Even though it's made by Hershey here in the U.S., we're safe. Yeah.
I would assume that Cadbury is putting pressure on them through a quick time.
I mean, where did Hershey get their cocoa beans?
I don't know.
That's where it can get money again. You know, I mean.
What's that?
That's where it gets money.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to determine the sources. Anything else? Any other questions?
I just think it sounds so similar to the, in the Northwest, you know, Starbucks. Mm-hmm. A big deal, and so we have thousands, don't we, Sarah, of choices of where to buy or who to buy our coffee from.
Yep.
And the advertising bars are in place. So it's a parable.
Okay, let's stop. You can turn off the mic now, or whoever's over there doing this.